nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
Okay, so let's continue our discussion of two-level logic synthesis. We've been discussing the Quine-McCluskey algorithm for two-level minimization to generate minimized two-level implementations of functions. To quickly recap what we've learned thus far, Quine-McCluskey algorithm can be captured in two simple steps. The first is the generation of all primes, and one of the key concepts proposed by Quine and McCluskey is when you're trying to search for the minimum sum of products implementation of a function, it is sufficient to restrict your attention to those only the primes of the function as opposed to the space of all implicants. So that in itself is a implicit reduction in the search space. And the second step of the Quine-McCluskey algorithm, which is the minimum covering step, essentially formulates the problem of selection of a primes. Once you've generated all the primes of the function, you need to select the minimum subset of primes. And as we saw, that problem can be formulated as a column covering problem. So you have this two-dimensional table with columns of the table representing primes of the function, rows of the table representing the minterms in the onset of the function, and you would like to pick a minimum subset of columns such that all the rows are covered. Right? So these are the two key problems involved in two-level minimization. And we left with the conclusion that explicit enumeration, although this is a great simplification and this formulates the problem in a rigorous manner such that now you can write a program perhaps to automate it, the challenge that we are left with, the major challenge, is that explicit enumeration of all possible subsets of primes is not feasible. Right? The number of primes is smaller than the number of implicants, as we have observed there, yet it can still be quite large. Right? Did anybody have a chance to look up the literature on number of primes?
It varies from 3 power n over 2 10 to 3 power n over n.
That's correct. So as we saw, the number of implicants, we worked this out in class, the number of implicants for a function with n variables is order of 3 power n. And we said that the number of primes hopefully is going to be smaller than that. So it turns out that the best known bound that has been proven, upper bound on the number of primes of a function with n variables, is order of 3 power n by square root of n. So it's a reduction by a factor of square root of n, which can be substantial if n is large. However, unfortunately, the numerator still grows much larger than the denominator. So for large n, this is much smaller than that, but still a very large number. Okay. And the other thing I'd like to mention in this context is there are functions that are known that have, so, you know, this is a bound. You might argue, you know, maybe this is a very loose bound. How do you know that in practice functions would have primes, this number of primes? In practice, there are examples of functions that are known which have 3 power n by n primes. So, you know, there is still some gap between what is known and the bound. So there is still a possibility that the bound may be somewhat loose, but even if you take 3 power n by n, this is still quite large for very large n, right? The exponential growth of the numerator is just very challenging. So explicit enumeration of all subsets of this set. So this is a set of primes, number of primes, and you need to take all possible subsets of that set. So that is very challenging. You do not want to be considering all possible subsets explicitly. So we need more efficient techniques to address this problem, and which is what we'll be talking about in this lecture. Okay. Some of the techniques which were, in fact, actually suggested back in the 50s by McCluskey himself are known as what are known as pruning techniques. Pruning techniques in general are techniques that help you reduce the size of the search space without explicit enumeration and without sacrificing optimality. Okay. We'll look at these pruning techniques using an example. Remember the concept of essential primes. We discussed essential prime implicants of a function. It's an essential prime is a prime that uniquely covers some minterm of the function. In other words, there exists a minterm that is covered just by this prime implicant and no other prime implicant, right? So how does essential identification of essential primes helps in the context of two-level minimization or finding the minimum two-level cover. Well, it turns out that essential primes must be included in the minimum cover. Okay, because remember, we are looking at covers that are only prime, consist of prime implicants. And among the subset of prime implicants, whatever that may be, up to order of 3 power n by root n, among that space of prime implicants, there only one of those prime implicants covers this onset minterm. And remember, any valid cover for a function must cover all the onset minterms. So since you're only restricted to looking at primes, and there exists only one prime that covers this onset minterm, you have no choice but to include this prime implicant in the cover. What does that do to your search space? Well, you don't need to really consider two scenarios for this prime. Do I include it or do I not? You know for sure you have to be including it. So if you look at this example of the covering table shown here, you can see that there is at least one essential prime. Can anybody identify what the essential prime is here? M1 is the minterm. Remember, the rows are minterms and the columns are primes. So yes, M1 is the minterm that is covered only by one prime, and the essential prime is P1. So if you identify the fact that the row M1 has only one entry of 1 and all the other entries are zeros, that is equivalent to saying that M1 is an essential prime. Is a minterm covered by an essential prime. And the corresponding column P1 is that essential prime. So you know that you need to include P1 in the minimum cover. You don't need to consider all the, both the possibilities of whether it's included or not. And when you're including P1 in the minimum cover, then you also know that M2 is also automatically covered by P1. So what that means is that you have effectively reduced the covering table. Because you've taken P1 out of the covering table, you know that this has to be included in the cover. And if it is included in the cover, you know that M1 and M2 have also been covered, have also been covered. So now the reduced covering table consists of 6 rows and 7 columns. Originally started by 8 by 8, started the 8 by 8 covering table, and now you have one which is reduced, 6 rows and 7 columns. So this is one of the examples of pruning techniques, right? Identify essential primes, include them in the cover, remove all minterms that are covered by them. Let's look at other examples. Dominance. So the pruning technique simply stated says remove dominating rows. What does a dominating row mean? Here's the definition of a dominating row. Row I2 dominates row I1 if the set of primes of I1 is contained in the set of primes of I2. So here's an example of two rows. Remember, rows correspond to onset minterms, and the one entries means that the prime corresponding to the column covers that onset minterm. So if you look at rows I1 and I2, you will see that whenever I1 has a 1, in whichever columns I1 has a 1, I2 also has a 1. Right? So that's what we mean by row dominance. So in this case, the set of positions where I2 has a 1 is a superset of the set of positions where you have a 1 in row I1. So in this case, row I2 is said to dominate I1. Now, when you have this kind of a situation, one row dominating another row, it turns out that you can remove the dominating row. Why? Remember that you need to select primes such that all of the minterms are covered, all rows are covered. Suppose I2 were removed from the covering table, you would still need to select primes such that I1 is covered, and any of those primes that would cover I1 would automatically also cover I2. Therefore, you do not need to explicitly include I2 in the covering table to get a correct solution. You can exclude it, and the fact that you're covering I1 automatically implies that I2 will be covered for free in addition. Right? So remove dominating rows. This, of course, helps reduce the size of the covering table. A special case of this is that if you have identical rows, clearly one of those two can be removed because they're covered by exactly the same set of primes. You know, it doesn't matter which one you keep. You will end up getting a valid cover. So again, observe that the net effect of this pruning technique, row dominance, is to actually reduce the size of the covering table. The concept of dominance can also be applied to columns in the covering table, right? We've talked about applying it to rows. In the context of columns, the rule states remove dominated columns. In the case of rows, it was remove dominating rows. Note the difference here. It says remove the dominated columns. First, the definition of dominance is same as before. column J1 dominates column J2 if the set of rows it covers is a superset of the set of rows that J2 covers. In other words, intuitively, in this case, you see that column J1 has ones in positions wherever J2 has ones, and in other positions as well. So the locations where J1 has 1 is a superset of the set of locations where J2 has a 1. So J1 dominates J2. In this case, you remove J2. Right? Remove the dominated columns. Why? Because any cover, any minimum cover that you includes J2 as part of the solution can be replaced by an equivalent minimum cover where you remove J2 and you include J1 instead of J2. Any of the minset, onset minterms that are covered by J2 will also be covered by J1. If anything, J1 is only going to cover more minterms. So suppose there exists a minimum cover with J2 in it, remove J2 and put J1 inside, and that will still be a minimum cover. So you don't need to explicitly keep J2 anymore. You can, as long as J1 is available in the covering table, that is sufficient. So you can remove dominated columns, in other words. Any questions thus far? Okay, so again, I'll point out that all of these techniques, essential primes, row dominance and column dominance, effectively reduce the size of the covering table. And what is interesting is what makes these techniques the most powerful is that these can be applied in an iterative manner. You may start off with the original covering table and you may identify one opportunity for essential primes and you may not be able to apply row or column dominance. But once you remove the essential prime and the minterms it covers, you have a reduced covering table. Now that reduced covering table may suddenly have new opportunities for potentially row dominance or column dominance. And then applying one of these may create another essential prime in the yet reduced covering table and so on and so forth. So it is the recursive, repeated application of these pruning techniques in practice that has a very, very substantial effect. It has a very drastic effect on the size of the covering table. The covering table gets drastically reduced. Okay. A special case, of course, of column dominance is the fact that identical columns, again, you know, one of them can be removed. You can just keep one of the identical, one of the duplicates, and remove the others. So as I mentioned, how do you put all of these pruning techniques together into a coherent procedure? Well, this is one way to do it. Apply these techniques iteratively as follows. First, start off with your original covering table. Identify the essential primes, right, which are primes that uniquely cover some minterm. Include them in the solution. Remove the essential prime from the covering table as well as all the minterms that it covers. Then, remove dominating rows and dominated columns, as we just saw. And now, if the table has changed, in other words, if either you are able to identify one or more essential primes or any dominating row or any dominating column, the covering table has been reduced. Now there's a new covering table. Potentially you have an opportunity to do something else. So you have to keep going and going back and repeating these three steps iteratively until you go through an iteration where the covering table is not changed. Then you know that you are done. Okay. So let's work through that with an example. For simplicity here, I'm not going to include the zeros. I'm just going to write down the ones. And blank entry just means a zero. So we can... Okay. Did I get this right?
There are two locations.
Pardon?
There are two locations which are one.
In which one?
Second row.
Second row? So I have two locations.
Oh,
two more locations. I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. All right. Okay. So now the first thing that we already noticed was that P1 is an essential prime. I'm just going to write P, saying that this is an essential prime. So what you do is you basically remove P1 from the covering table. You also remove M1 and M2 from the covering table. Okay, so now you're left with the reduced covering table. Now, do we have any more instances of essential primes here? Are there any other rows in the reduced covering table? Now forget about the rest. This is your reduced covering table. This is all you need to focus on. Okay, do we have any instances? Imagine that this was your original covering table. Are there any instances of essential primes here? No, because you do not have any row with just one entry, a single one entry. So there is no essential primes. However, there are other techniques, the other two techniques, row and column dominance, that we could look at. So do we have any instances of row dominance here? M6 and M8. That's correct. So M6 dominates M8. So what do we remove in this case? We remove? Sorry, M8 dominates M6, rather. The row with more ones always dominates. The definition of what is dominating and which one is the dominated is the same for rows and columns, just to be consistent. The one that has more one entries is the dominating, right? So in this case, M8 dominates M6, so we delete M8. Okay. Anything else? No other row dominance. Do we have anything, any column dominance relationships here? P3 dominates P2. So what do we remove? The dominating or dominated? The dominated column. So we remove P2 in this case. So you can remove P2. Okay. So now you've reduced. P3 dominates P4 as well. So you can remove P4. Okay. What else? P5 dominates P8. So now you can remove P8 as well. P5. No, P5 does not dominate P7 because each of them has a one entry and where the other has a zero. So neither of them dominate the other. But now look at from a column dominance point of view, I think we're done. Are there any row dominance relationships remaining now? M4 dominates M3, correct? So remove M4. Anything else now? Remember now, if you look at M3, there is only one prime that covers it, P3. So in this reduced covering table now, M3 has become essential. So include P3. I'm just going to mark this down as essential because we need to include it in the final solution. And having done that, we can remove M3 and P3 from further consideration. Okay. Now, anything else here? I think we are about done, right? You have basically what remains is this set of three rows and three columns. Okay, so you started off with an 8x8 covering table, and by recursive application of these pruning techniques, the order in which you apply these pruning techniques is not necessarily unique. If you look at the next slide, you know, I have listed an alternative order, but eventually in that case, the solution that you come up with is the same. Once you've applied all the pruning techniques until you can apply them no further, you get this, in this case, greatly reduced subset of the covering table. Okay. Now, you need to solve this covering problem. But that is, of course, much easier than solving an 8x8 problem, right? So now you have only a 3x3 covering table, and you need to solve this, okay? So this remainder, what remains after you completed the application of the pruning techniques and you can apply them no more, is referred to as the cyclic core. So the minimum solution or minimum column cover of the original table is derived by getting the solution to the cyclic core, in this case, the minimum set of columns that cover all these three rows, M5, M6, and M7, and that you can see that picking any two of those three should do the job. Either pick P5 and P6, or P5 and P7, or P6 and P7. Any of the two will do the job. So those two, and plus the set of essential primes that you had noted down when applying the pruning techniques, because essential primes have to be included in the cover, right? So the solution to the covering problem is any two of these three plus P1 plus P3. So you need four primes. That is the minimum number of product terms or prime implicants you need to cover to solve the covering problem. Hopefully the example has illustrated the power of these pruning techniques, the fact that they can enable each other and therefore be applied iteratively, you know, lends to their great utility in practice. In practice, you can start off with covering tables that are millions of rows and columns, and by iteratively applying these things, you can reduce them by several orders of magnitude. Right? So this is a very useful approach. Even though the ideas are very simple, these are techniques that have great benefit in practice. So you can, you know, go through this as a homework exercise to verify the alternate sequence of steps, but eventually you end up in the same core. So a general principle that is useful in many other instances in design automation beyond just two-level minimization is that pruning techniques are a very useful concept. They eliminate portions of the search space that cannot yield the desired result. So rather than enumerating all combinations, which is what typically leads to complexity in CAD, right? The fact that you have to enumerate several possible combinations, if you have techniques that can identify parts of your search space that cannot yield the desired result, in this case, they cannot yield the minimum solution, and get rid of them, that is always going to help. Okay. We'll come back to this concept later in this lecture, but I thought I'd point this out, because this is a recurring concept in several algorithms that you come across in this area of design automation. Okay, so let's summarize what we've learned about Quine-McCluskey thus far. It can be used to derive minimum two implementations for a function. The key concept, one of the key concepts that they proposed was to restrict the search space from the space of all implicants to the space of primes, and to formulate the selection of primes as a column covering problem. Okay. So you construct the covering table and perform column covering on it. And we've also seen that pruning techniques based on essential primes, row and column equality and dominance help greatly in reducing the size of the covering table. What we've not talked about yet is I glossed over the problem of solving the cyclic core, right? And, you know, in most cases, for the scale of functions that Quine and McCluskey were interested in optimizing, the scale of circuits that they came across, application of the pruning techniques would result in cyclic cores that were small enough to be solved either by exhaustive enumeration, in this case, just enumerate all subsets of three, which is not a big deal, or visual inspection. Just by visually inspecting it, you can see what's the minimum. Okay. Of course, as functions grow larger and larger, that is not feasible anymore. So we need some systematic algorithmic techniques to solve these cyclic cores. And these are, in some sense, the toughest subproblems. You applied all the easy pruning techniques, and these are the most computationally challenging cores of the original problem. We still need efficient techniques to solve that. And we assumed that the covering table was given to us. We did not talk about how to generate the primes. You know, it's great that I only need to look at prime implicants and not all possible implicants, but in order to use that in a practical way, I need an efficient procedure to actually generate the primes. So how do you do that? And then we'll conclude with some discussion of scaling challenges and possible solutions. Okay. So the rest of this lecture is going to be focusing on solving the cyclic core. So you created the covering table, applied all these pruning techniques, you have this reduced covering table, and that is still too large to solve solve manually or exhaustively. There's four different techniques that have been proposed. I've highlighted the branch and bound because that is the most commonly used in practice. But nevertheless, each of these techniques illustrates different ways of solving the same challenging computational problem. So we're going to briefly discuss each of them in the lecture with a focus on branch and bound. We'll start off with Petrick's method. The key idea here in Petrick's method is to apply techniques from Boolean expression simplification. Remember the laws of Boolean algebra? Given a Boolean expression, you can keep applying those laws of Boolean algebra to simplify Boolean expressions. And many of you have probably done that in your undergraduate digital design classes. Well, those concepts, it turns out, can also be applied to solve the covering problem that arises in two-level minimization. Okay? How can you do that? Let's see. The first step, so we are starting off with the covering table. So a common starting point for all these four methods we're going to be talking about is the covering table. You have the columns representing primes, rows representing minterms. Right? Given the covering table, the first step in Petrick's method is to construct a Boolean expression. This is different from the original Boolean expression for the original function itself. This Boolean expression represents all possible solutions to the covering problem. It represents it in an implicit manner. In other words, this is a Boolean function or a logic function which is true when and only when all rows of your covering table are covered. And let's see through an example how you actually generate this. So here is an example function. By the way, for those of you who are not familiar with this notation, are all of you familiar with the minterm notation here of specifying a function? So these minterms correspond to, if you translate each of those numbers in the sigma, inside the sigma or m, into binary, that is the minterm that you're talking about. So in this case, you have a function of four variables. So, you know, 0 corresponds to 0, 0, 0, 0. In other words, A prime, B prime, C prime, D prime. 2 corresponds to 0, 0, 1, 0. That is A prime, B prime, C, D prime, and so on. Okay, so that is one of the notations that you use to specify Boolean functions. Suppose we have gone through the process of generating the prime implicants for this function. We have constructed the covering table as shown here. The original covering table had one essential prime implicant, A prime, B prime, which has already been removed along with the corresponding minterms that it covered. And this is the cyclic core, right? This is the reduced covering table. Let's take a minute to make sure that none of the pruning techniques can still be applied. I think that should be the case. If you look at this covering table, you do not have any instances of essential primes because every row has at least two entries of one. So there's no essential primes. You do not have column dominance. If you look at any two columns, you do not have any instance of dominating columns or dominating rows. Right? So this is a reduced covering table. Right? It's a cyclic core. In this case, it's slightly larger than the previous one. You know, it's 6 by 6 is the size of the cyclic core here. Now, how do you construct the Boolean expression that is referred to here? You need a Boolean expression which will be true when and only when all these minterms are covered. Okay? The way you construct the Boolean expression is by looking at each of the rows and writing down a sum term or a clause that expresses the constraints of that row. Okay? What does that mean? First of all, what are the variables in the Boolean expression? The variables in the Boolean expression, in this Boolean expression, are going to be variables representing the decisions you make in the covering problem. What are the decisions you make in the covering problem? Should I include this column or not? That's a 0 or 1, right? So, you know, in this case, we've chosen lowercase p, p1 to denote the primes. So let's just say capital P1 is a variable which is 1 if the prime, lowercase p1, is in the cover. Right? You're trying to find a minimum cover or a minimum subset of primes. Each of these primes may be in the cover or not. Corresponding to that, you create these Boolean variables. Okay, so P1 and so on and so forth, right? P1 through P6. Now, what does the first row of the covering table tell you? The minterm M3 can be covered either by including prime P1 in the cover or by including prime P2 in the cover. So you need at least one of those two, either of those two to be included. So what you need is either capital P1 has got to be 1, in other words, prime P1 is included in the cover, or capital P2 has got to be 1. the constraint that this min term M3 has got to be covered by at least one of the primes that you select is converted to this Boolean expression capital P1 or capital P2. Right? Similarly, the second row, M5, can be a constraint that it poses can be written as P3 or P4, because one of those two primes has got to be included in the cover. And similarly, you can enumerate clauses or some terms corresponding to each of these rows. And note that all of the onset min terms have got to be covered. So all these constraints have got to be simultaneously satisfied. So you take the conjunction or the logical AND of all of these. That results in an expression which is naturally in the product of sums or conjunctive normal form. Right? So that is the expression that you get. So in this case, if you work through it, you will see that we wrote down the first two clauses. If you enumerate write down the clauses for the rest of the rows, you'll see that that's the expression that you end up with. Now, this expression is directly not in a form that is useful to us. This is in product of some form. We would like to convert this expression into sum of products form by multiplying it out, right? This is just simple algebraic multiplication, right? P1 or P2 and P3 or P4. You can just multiply out all the pairs of terms and keep simplifying using the basic laws of Boolean algebra. In particular, the law that is going to be useful is the absorption law, which says x or xy is x. Okay? So whenever you have common variables, for instance, P1 is common to these two, P3 is common to these two, that absorption law will help you reduce the number of terms. So as you keep multiplying this out and keep simplifying by applying that rule of Boolean algebra, you go through the intermediate steps, you will end up with an expression that looks like this. This is the equivalent sum of products expression for the product of sums that we started off with. Okay? So this is the second step. And if you look at each of the product terms in this SOP expression, what does each of those product terms represent? What does P1, P4, P5 represent? It represents the case when you include prime P1 and you include prime P4 and you include prime P5 in the cover. And what this tells you, remember, this entire expression is equivalent to the covering table. The covering table gives you the set of constraints specifying what needs to be included in the cover. And that exact set of constraints has been encoded as a Boolean expression. And these Boolean expressions are equivalent. So you would like this entire P to evaluate to true. What is the property of a sum of products expression? If any one of the product terms is 1, the expression automatically evaluates to a 1. What that means is that this is a solution to the covering problem. P1, P4, P5 is a solution to the covering problem. Similarly, P1, P3, P5, P6 is another solution to the covering problem. So what you've done by multiplying out these terms and simplifying is that you have essentially analytically derived all possible solutions, feasible solutions to the covering problem. Once you've done that, what you need to do is pick the product term. Remember, we are interested in the minimum solution. So given each of these product terms here, you can calculate its cost with respect to the original function. So if your cost is the number of prime implicants, you just need to count the number of literals here. So this term has 3 prime implicants, plus of course your essential prime that you started off with, but that of course is common in all the cases. So here you have 3 prime implicants, 4, 4, and so on. So if you look at the solutions that give you the minimum number of prime implicants, for instance, they would be P1, P4, P5. That's one possible solution. The other possible solution is P2, P3, P6. So these would be your minimum solutions. So based on these, now you can go back to the covering table. You know what those primes correspond to in terms of the original function, the product terms they correspond to. So write those things down and remember to include your essential prime that you started off with. And this gives you the final minimum sum of product solution to the original function. Does it make sense? Any questions about Petrick's method? 3 steps. First step is construct a product of sums expression from the original covering table. This just captures the constraints that each of these rows has got to be covered. Each row translates into a clause. Since all rows need to be covered, you take the conjunction of all those clauses. So you have that expression in product of sums form. multiply those things out, apply the basic laws of Boolean algebra to simplify that expression, convert it to sum of products form, and in that sum of products form, look at the product terms that have fewest literals. That corresponds to the fewest number of primes that can suffice to cover, to solve the original covering problem. And use that to directly derive, translate that into the solution for the original covering problem. Okay. So it's a pretty straightforward technique, and something that you can envision automating. Yes?
You're taking or and not and, right? In or. The previous slide. Like, these are all ors?
Here?
Yeah.
That's correct. Because remember that these are all prime implicants of the original function. Mm-hmm. So you need to remember that this expression and this are very different. This expression is a solution to the covering problem. This expression is a cover for the function you started off with. So you're starting off with the function, constructing its covering table, deriving the solutions to the covering problem in this form, and using one of these product terms to derive the entire sum of products for the original function. Yeah, so this has to be OR, because each of these are prime implicants or cubes of the original function. You have to take the disjunction of the cubes. So this is a relatively straightforward procedure. You can envision applying this to any cyclic core. You know, it's a very general procedure. However, the problem with this is that it explicitly obtains all possible solutions in order to compute the minimum. Right? So what you're doing is, remember that you construct this sum of products expression which has all possible solutions to the problem. And only then you pick one of them which gives you the minimum. Okay, so in a sense, this is overkill. You only want one solution. This algorithm is doing way more work than needed. And therefore, in practice, it's not likely to be very scalable, because, you know, it's something that is doing much more than you really need to do. Nevertheless, it's an interesting approach, because it takes the basic techniques of Boolean algebra and Boolean expression simplification and applies them to solve the covering problem. Okay, we'll move on to the second technique. So one of the techniques to solve the cyclic core is Petrick's method. The second technique shares one of the steps with the Petrick's method, which is the first step. So as before, you start off with the reduced covering table, construct this product of sums or CNF expression that captures all possible solutions to the covering problem. The place where Petrick's method goes astray, if you will, is when it tries to multiply this out into sum of products. Remember that the process of multiplying out a product of sums into sum of products can potentially lead to an exponential blow up in the worst case. And furthermore, we are not interested in all possible solutions. We are only interested in one solution. So the first step of Petrick's method is fine. This is just linear. This is a direct translation of the covering table. This is, if, you know, whatever size your covering table is, this is going to be proportional to the covering table, this expression. The second method, what it's going to do is start off with the result of the first step, which is the CNF formula, and apply minSAT. We have not talked about satisfiability in detail yet. We'll be talking about it in the next module, because your course projects are going to be based on satisfiability. But in a sense, the satisfiability problem refers to, given a CNF formula, find an assignment to all the variables in the CNF formula such that the entire formula evaluates to true. This is an instance of the satisfiability problem, because you would like this entire expression to evaluate to true. However, you would like a minimum cost solution. So you would like to have a minimum number of variables to be assigned to true. Okay? That variant of the SAT problem is known as minSAT. Okay? You would like to satisfy the Boolean expression while assigning minimum number of variables to any value. Okay? In this case, to 1. So, once again, you construct the product of sums from the table and directly feed this to a minSAT solver, which is going to give you the answer. And the minSAT solver, so SAT solvers, as we will see in the next module of the course, are pretty advanced. They can deal with formulae which have millions of variables and millions of clauses. Okay. So essentially what this technique does is it leverages advances in SAT solvers. It's translating one NP-complete problem to another NP-complete problem, right? Because SAT is also an NP-complete problem. But you're leveraging all the practical advances and techniques that have been developed for SAT solvers and applying them, bringing them to bear on the column covering problem. And it turns out, one final remark I'd like to make is that the SAT formulae or CNF formulae that result from the covering table are have a special structure. What is that special structure? Well, they are known as unate formulae because you have all variables in them appearing only in uncomplemented form. You don't know, if you notice this, you'll never have a complemented form of a variable. So this is the unate covering problem. And the formula that results from this is known as a unate formula because you all you have variables only in uncomplemented form. And it turns out that that is actually useful because if you know that a problem has this structure of unateness, it's still NP-complete, unfortunately. But there are some special techniques in SAT, in MinSAT, that can be used to more efficiently solve large formulae that are unate. So that is step technique number two. Petrick's method is the first approach. Second method is MinSAT. The first step is the same as Petrick's method, except take this formula and directly feed it into a MinSAT solver. I know it's a little bit of a black box at this point. We haven't talked about how MinSAT itself works, but we will be getting to that in a few weeks. Okay, a couple of weeks. Okay, now let's get to the third method that I'm going to talk about today, which is branch and bound, which is probably the most commonly used in practice to solve the covering problem. Okay. So, in order to describe what branch and bound is, let's go back to the search tree. Remember the search tree that we constructed initially when we talked about the column covering problem? We said that you could represent the set of all possible solutions in the form of a search tree. Each node of the search tree represents a decision of whether you include one prime in the cover or you do not include. So in this case, you have two possible branches at each node, two possible outcomes for the decision, either P1 is in your cover or P1 is out of your cover. And for each of those cases, again, you can look at another prime, P2, and say whether it's in or out. And you do this recursively. You have this exponential size tree with 2 power n possible cases of each prime being included or excluded from the cover. Those would be the leaves of this tree, and those represent the set of all possible enumerations of all possible solutions to the covering problem. And you can pick the leaf here that corresponds to, that is a valid cover, in other words, that covers all the rows of the covering table, yet it has fewest ins in the path leading down to that leaf. In other words, the least number of primes are actually included in that solution, right? So that was just a conceptual way of thinking of the search space. Of course, you can actually explicitly construct the search tree and traverse all the leaves and find out the best solution. The problem is that that is, again, exponential in the number of primes. Okay, number of primes is already large. Now this is exponential in terms of that large number. So this is definitely something you'd like to avoid. However, in branch and bound, the key concept is to traverse the search tree, but try to avoid traversing the entire search tree. Okay, so you know it is like enumerating all possible solutions, except that try to avoid visiting each and every node of the tree. Well, how do you avoid visiting each and every node of the tree? Remember that internal nodes of the tree correspond to partial solutions, right? So, for example, if you look at this internal node of the tree, it corresponds to a partial solution where P1 has been included in the cover, and the other primes, you don't know whether they're included or not, right? So that's a partial solution. If you could use a bound, we'll see in a minute what a bound means, but if I gave you some way of saying that at this point in the search space, or at this point in the search space, all possible solutions that you can reach by going down this subtree are guaranteed to be suboptimal. In other words, you cannot find an optimal solution by going down this entire subtree. If somehow I could magically tell you that, then what you would do is you would say, hey, why should I waste my time going and checking all of these 2 power n minus 1 possible solutions? I'm going to just ignore this entire subtree and say that I'll focus only on this subtree. So I've cut my search space in half if I do that, right? So branch and bound, again, conceptually corresponds to enumeration of all possibilities. However, without waiting until you reach the leaves of the search tree, without waiting until you have complete solutions, you try to, at intermediate points in the search, you try to decide whether it is profitable, it makes sense to go down the subtree or not. And if it does not make sense, as early as possible, you terminate the search and you bound. Or you backtrack. Sometimes it's also called backtrack, but you bound. Okay, so use a bound to decide when to eliminate infeasible or suboptimal portions of the search tree. Let's look at a concrete. Let's try to make this concept a little more concrete. So suppose I gave you this function, L standing for lower bound of T of V. So T of V, T is the entire tree. T of V is the subtree that is rooted at any particular vertex V in the tree. Suppose I give you this function lower bound L of T of V, which computes the lower bound on the cost that will be incurred if you go down the subtree. In other words, I have chosen to, in this case, not include P1 in my cover. And at this point, if I could somehow tell you that with the covering table that you have and with the decisions that you made thus far, you will need to include at least so many primes, a lower bound, at least so many primes in the solution if you go down all of these paths. Or any of these paths, you would need at least so many primes. If you had such a lower bound, and you also knew the cost of the current solution, which means that in this case, the cost of the current solution is zero because you've chosen not to include P1. If you were at this node, the cost of the current solution would be 1, which is a partial cost. Based on the decisions you made thus far, how many primes have you actually included in the cover already? That is the cost of the current solution, plus the lower bound. If that itself is greater than or equal to the best solution that you've seen so far. So remember that initially you start off the branch and bound process. Initially, you will not have seen any best solution. Your best solution is infinity. So you will be going down one path of the tree. You will find a solution. Then, as you try to look at other parts of the tree, you keep track of the best solution. You use this bound and compare the cost of the current solution plus the bound to the best solution you've seen so far. Now, if that is greater than or equal to the best solution, then what does it mean? It means that even if you go down the subtree and look at all possible paths, you cannot do any better than you already done. You already have a solution of this that has this cost, the best solution seen so far. If you go down the subtree, you can, in the best case, do as good as something you already have. Well, you're only interested in one minimum solution. You don't care about anything else. So unless you can improve on the minimum solution that you already have seen, you know, at some point in the search space, you do not go down that subtree anymore. So, in order for this technique to be effective, to recap, the way branch and bound works is that initially you go down to a leaf of the search tree, find a solution, record the, at any point in the search, you keep track of the best solution that you've seen so far, and as you visit different nodes of the tree, before you go down to that subtree, compute the lower bound, check if it makes sense to go down that subtree. If it doesn't make sense, stop right there. Okay, so rather than going down to all the leaves of the tree, you're essentially terminating your search. Eventually, you will need to consider all possibilities in the tree, but in many cases, you might, if you terminate your search early on, before you reach the entire leaves of the final leaves of the tree, you would have saved a considerable amount of time in doing the search. In order for this procedure to be effective, the question I have for you is, what would be a desirable bound? What would be a desirable function L? Would you like it to be as high as possible or as low as possible? You would like the bounding technique to be effective. So what you need, remember, you have, so let's say that, you know, this is the actual minimum cost. If you were to actually explore this entire subtree exhaustively, this would be the actual minimum cost. You want a bound that is, it's a lower bound. You wouldn't want it to be a valid lower bound. So of course it's going to be, you know, less than this. But would you like it to be as low as possible or as high as possible? As high as possible. You want the lower bound to be tight. Why do you want the lower bound to be? Well, any lower bound is going to be fine for the branch and bound. It's a correct algorithm. The optimality of the algorithm does not change. You are always, in all cases, searching through the entire search tree. This algorithm is optimal. What changes with the quality of the bound is the runtime of the algorithm. The algorithm is going to run faster if you have a more effective bound. What is an effective bound? An effective bound is one that is as high as possible, because only, remember, you would like the bounding to happen as, the more frequently the bounding occurs, the better for you, right? Because you're saving some time searching through that entire subtree. So when will the bound happen more frequently? You would like this to be true. this condition to be true as often as possible. So you would like this to be as large as possible because it is on the left-hand side and you have a greater than or equal to, right? So you would like L to be as large as possible, or in other words, you need a bound that is as tight as possible. Okay. So this is the general framework of branch and bound, right? It is a technique for exhaustive search, but rather than explicitly enumerating all possible solutions, the use of a bound allows you to terminate the search early on in the search process or at higher levels of the search tree, thereby saving time and in practice hopefully avoiding the exponential complexity. Okay. In the worst case, it is going to be exponential, but in most practical cases, the hope is that this terminates much earlier than exponential time. Okay, let's look at one example of a bound that you can use in the context of covering, right? So I intentionally kept the description of branch and bound generic because it's a technique that can be applied, the way we described it, can be applied to any search problem, any search type optimization problem, right? Not just covering. Covering is only one instance of such a problem that branch and bound is useful for. Okay. So now, coming back to covering, what is a good bounding technique that we can use to compute a bound for the covering problem? Okay. Computing a good bound is the crux of having a good branch and bound technique. Okay. So in the case of covering, we will look at one technique called maximal independent set. And this, it turns out that this is a pretty, in practice, turns out to be a pretty effective way of computing a bound for using branch and bound in two level minimization. We define an independent set of T. T is a covering table, right? A table consisting of the columns and rows, primes and minterms. So an independent set of T is a set containing some of the rows of T, a subset of the rows, such that no two of them are covered by the same column. In other words, the rows are pairwise disjoint. What do we mean by that? Here is an example of a covering table or a fragment of a covering table. Again, these are the rows which are the minterms. Columns correspond to the primes. If you look at these rows out here, they are pairwise disjoint. In other words, if you take any two rows here, you do not have a common prime that can cover both the rows. And that holds true for any of the pair of rows, right? If you look at the places where the ones are in each of these rows, they are completely disjoint positions where the ones are, right? What that means is that if you have a covering table with these three rows in it, it can be of any size, as long as these three rows are embedded in the covering table, what does that tell you? You need at least three primes to cover it. Why? Because to cover this row, you'll need either the first or second prime, but they're not going to be of any help for the other rows in the disjoint set. For this row, you need either the third or the fourth primes, and this row, you need the fifth or sixth primes, right? So you cannot cover any two of these rows by selecting only one prime. In other words, the number of primes you need to solve this entire covering table is at least equal to the size of the independent set, right? So once again, an independent set of rows are rows that where pairwise they are disjoint. You do not have any common column with more than one entry. And any independent set is a lower bound, it's a valid lower bound on the number of primes you need. So in the context of covering, the size of the independent set is a good lower bound to use. However, you'd like the lower bound to be as large as possible. So what you're really looking for is the maximal independent set, or the independent set that is as large as possible. Okay. A trivial independent set, as if you take any one of the rows, it's an independent set by itself. But that's not going to be of much use in practice. Okay. You'd like a large independent set. And so given any covering table corresponding to the intermediate point in the search tree that you are at, you would like to compute the maximal independent set of that covering table. How do you construct the maximal independent set? Okay. This might be familiar for some of you who've done 608, but if not, don't worry. It's for the purpose of this class, you just need to have an intuitive understanding of this. So the way we solve in the context of covering, the way you can solve maximal independent set is, one way to do it is by constructing an equivalent graph problem. You construct a graph whose vertices correspond to the rows of the covering table. In other words, the minterms. So you have M3, M5, M7, and so on. So you have the vertices of the graph as shown here. Draw edges between two vertices if there exists a prime that covers both of those. So here, for example, prime P1 covers M3 and M7. So you would draw an edge between M3 and M7. Let's go ahead and draw out the graph. If you look at P1, it covers both M3 and M7. Therefore, you draw an edge from M3 to M7. Okay. If you look at P2, it covers M3 and M11. So again, you draw out an edge from M3 to M11. Right. Similarly, P3 results in an edge from M5 to M7. P4, M5 to M13. P5, M9, and M11. And P6, M9, and M13. Okay. So this is the equivalent graph that represents the pairwise relationships between the rows of the covering table and tells you what are disjoint. So in this graph, a pair of disjoint rows corresponds to a pair of vertices without any edge between the two vertices. So now, what is a maximal independent set in terms of the graph? It is a subset of vertices such that you do not have any edge between any two pairs of vertices, any two vertices in that set. So in this case, can you give me an example of an independent set, first of all? If you look at M3 and M5, are they an independent set? Yes, because you do not have any edge between M3 and M5. Similarly, M3 and M13 are also another independent set. So, you know, that immediately tells you that the independent set is not unique. You can have different possible independent sets. But what we are looking for, recall, is the maximal independent set, something that is as large as possible. So we have several independent sets here of size 2. Do we have an independent set of cardinality 3? Can you give me an example of
M3,
M5, and M9 as one example of independent set of cardinality 3. M13, M11, and M7 is another example. So you have, again, a few possibilities, but you do have an independent set of cardinality 3. Yeah. Okay. So this is one way of solving the independent set problem to compute a bound for using in branch and bound when you're doing covering. However, the irony of this is that the independent set problem on a graph is also itself NP-complete. Okay. So we are now at a sort of chicken and egg situation, right? We started off with one NP-complete problem, which is column covering. We're trying to use branch and bound to solve it. Great, branch and bound is useful in practice. But you need to compute a bound if you want to implement branch and bound. Now, we have this great idea of computing a bound, but unfortunately, the technique to compute, the problem of computing a good bound is itself NP-complete. Okay. This is not uncommon. In fact, many instances in CAD, when you're trying to solve a problem, you encounter embedded instances of NP-complete problems when you're trying to solve one. However, the good news here is that the bound does not need to be exact. It just needs to be as good as possible. So you do not need to optimally solve. We're still trying to optimally solve the original covering problem. But you do not need to optimally solve the independent set problem. A high-quality solution here is sufficient, right? Because the quality of the solution here only controls the effectiveness of bounding and therefore the runtime of the branch and bound, which you would like to minimize. But you're not sacrificing optimality of the original two-level minimization if this is not exact. So one example of a algorithm to solve the maximal independent set problem, a heuristic algorithm, is a greedy algorithm where you look at all possible rows in the covering table, select one of those rows that has a minimum weight, and we're going to be defining weight shortly. But suppose you could come up with some way of specifying the desirability of a row, include that in the maximal independent set, delete all the other rows that have a common one entry in some column, where some column covers this row and some other row, delete all those other rows, and keep doing this until you have no more rows left in your set. And whatever you added to the maximal independent set you know, every time you go through this loop, you're adding a new row to the maximal independent set and deleting all other rows that have overlap with it. In other words, that are not disjoint with it, with the row that you just added. Once you end up with exhausting the original set of rows, in other words, everything has either gone into the MIS or has been deleted, then what remains in the MIS at the termination of this loop is going to be one possible independent set. It is not guaranteed to be the largest possible, but, you know, hopefully if this heuristic works well, it's going to be large. How do you define the weight? There's two possibilities of defining the weight. Remember, you want the MIS to be as large as possible. So the most intuitive definition of weight is the number of ones in the row, because a row which doesn't have too many ones is not likely to overlap with too many other rows. Remember, if a row overlaps with many other rows, you'll be deleting a lot of them, and therefore you may not have a whole lot of rows left to keep going through this loop. Every time you go through this loop, you're adding something to the independent set. So you would like to ideally go through this loop as many times as possible. How will that happen? If you delete as few rows as possible. Well, how will that happen in turn? If you have minimum overlap, and this is just a heuristic or an estimate of rows, a quick and dirty way of identifying rows that are less likely to have overlap with other rows. If you have to have overlap, you need to have a one in the row and one in some other row. But if this row has very few ones, hopefully it means it has very little overlap. The chances of overlap are lower. A slightly more complex definition of overlap is the number of ones in the columns that cover the row. In other words, this is your covering table. This is the row that you're considering. Let's say it has ones in a few positions. Count the number of ones in these columns and call that your weight. Okay. So that is just a number. For every row, you can count the weight and compare the weight across all the rows, pick the row with the least weight, and include that in your maximal independent set and keep iterating this. This is a pretty efficient algorithm, right? It is at most quadratic. You can think of a quadratic complexity algorithm in terms of the size of the covering table to implement this, right? So you can basically, because you need to look at pairs of rows in order to compute what is disjoint or not. So given that, you know, you can compute this relatively efficiently, right? And it's still going to be a valid lower bound. So this is one way of backing up. This is one way of computing a lower bound for branch and bound, and therefore solving the original covering problem relatively efficiently. Any questions about the maximal independent set, how we compute the bound? Okay, maybe let's work through an example of this, and that might make it a little easier. So for this example, let's use the weight of the row as the number of ones in the row. So in this case, if you look at row 1 through 6, each of them has a weight of 2. So, you know, there is not a whole lot to distinguish in this case between the different rows in terms of weight. So initially you set, if you follow the procedure strictly that was in the previous slide, you set the set of all rows to 1 through 6, and the MIS is the empty set. Then the first step of the algorithm, you pick the row with the minimum weight. In this case, all of them have a weight 2, so let's arbitrarily pick row 1 and say MIS is, add row 1 to the MIS and delete all rows that overlap with row 1 from the set I. So, because they cannot no longer be included in the maximal independent set. So if you look at row 1, row 2 overlaps with row 1 and row 6 overlaps with row 1. So you have to delete row 2 and 6, rows 2 and 6 from the MIS, and of course row 1 itself. So that leaves 3, 4, and 5 in the MIS. Now, if you look at rows 3, 4, and 5, again, each of them has a weight of 2. So we can arbitrarily pick one of them and include that in the MIS. So the MIS, let's say we pick row 3. The independent set consists of rows 1 and 3. Now, if you look at row 3, it overlaps with row 4. So you'll need to remove both 3 and 4 from the set of rows under consideration, that is I, leaving row 5. And in the last iteration, you can add 5 to the MIS as well. So the final MIS you end up with consists of rows 3, 4, and 5. So the...
1, 3.
I'm sorry. 1, 3, and 5. 1, 3, and 5. So that's the way you go through the... So this is a greedy algorithm, because at any possible point, it doesn't look at all possibilities or all combinations of possibilities for including rows in the MIS, or it doesn't, in particular, it doesn't look at the implication of one decision on future decisions. It just greedily picks the decision that appears to be the best at that local point in time, and it uses the weight of the rows to make that decision. In this case, the weight is not of much help. The weight is actually the same in all the rows, but you go through the process and you end up with MIS, which is a valid lower bound. I'd leave it as a homework exercise for you to go through the same process for another table to compute the maximal independent set. But let's conclude by putting it together. So now we described this concept of branch and bound. We described a technique of MIS for computing the bound itself. So let's express the overall branch and bound algorithm in pseudocode, as shown here. So the most convenient way of describing the branch and bound algorithm is as a recursive function. So BB stands for branch and bound. It takes as its inputs T, which is the covering table, and it also takes the best solution and the current solution, because remember, the branch and the procedure, conceptually you can think of the procedure as traversing the different nodes of the search tree. So the current solution keeps track of where you currently are in that entire search process. The best solution records the best solution that you've seen thus far, because you need to use it for the purpose of bounding. Okay, so those are the two parameters. Initially, the best solution is infinity, and the current solution is the root of the tree, because that's where you start off your search. So initially, you call the branch and bound solution, and it looks a little complicated, but if you break it down line by line, it's actually pretty straightforward. The first thing you need to do in the branch and bound is that you need to apply the pruning techniques that we talked about, which is essential primes, equivalence, row and column equivalence, and row and column dominance to reduce the covering table. Remember that these pruning techniques, you know, can be applied not just at the beginning of the search, but also at every node in the search tree. Because once you make a decision, you have included one prime in the cover, and you have eliminated all the minterms it covers. So you have a reduced covering table. Now that's a new covering table. So even though pruning techniques may not have been applicable before, or you may have already applied them until they were no longer applicable, once you change the covering table by taking a subset of it, now pruning techniques may again become applicable. So you use pruning techniques not just at the beginning of the search, but at every node in that search tree, every point in the search process. So that's exactly what this says. This is reduce of T and current solution. If the pruning techniques result, as a result of that, the covering table becomes empty, what that means is that you have reached the leaf, a leaf of the search tree, right? Remember, as you go through the search process, you remove all the primes that you have included in the solution from the covering table, remove all the rows that they have covered. If all the rows are covered, it means you've reached the leaf of the search tree, right? You've reached a final solution. And then what you do is you compute the cost of the current solution, which is nothing but the number of primes that you have included in the cover thus far. Compute that cost, compare it to the cost of the best solution. If it is better than the best solution, you replace the best solution with the current solution. Otherwise, you just discard the current solution because it's inferior to the best you've already seen. So you've reached this block of code essentially corresponds to the case where you've reached a leaf of the search tree. If you have not reached a leaf of the search tree, this is the non-trivial case. You evaluate the bounding criterion, compute an MIS of the remaining table, and add the MIS cost, which is your lower bound, to the cost of the current solution. See if it is greater than or equal to the cost of the best solution. If so, this is the case where you bound. You reduce the search space. Because you've said now that I don't need to go down the subtree, I'm returning at this point, even though this is not a leaf of the search tree. When you cannot bound, then that is the case where you need to pick one of the primes. This is known as picking a branching heuristic, or the choice of a branching variable. You may have several columns left in the covering table. You pick one of them and say that now I'm going to consider both cases. One case is this column, this prime is included in the cover. Other cases, it's not included. So you need to make two recursive calls to the same branch and bound procedure. In other words, you traverse those two subtrees corresponding to the two children of this the current vertex you are at. So you need to make the recursive calls. In one case, you need to include this is the case where you include the current variable that you've chosen, the column, the prime that you've chosen in the solution. And in this is the case where you do not include it in the solution. So you remove it from the table, but you don't add it to the solution. In this case, you actually add it to the solution. Okay? So in each of these cases, if you have heuristic for further speed up. If the first case you're exploring, the first subtree, the case where you're including the prime in the solution, equals the lower bound, you know that the other case can do no better than that, because the lower bound is the best you can do. It's a bound on what you can do. So if you already achieved the lower bound, you don't need to explore the other case, and you return immediately. But on the other hand, if it is not, then you still need to explore the other case, and you return the better of the two solutions, okay, among these two. Right, so this is essentially the recursive call. So this is one way of visualizing it. Of course, in practice, you may not implement it, using a recursive method. From an implementation point of view, it may not be the most efficient, but to think about it, and from a pseudocode point of view, it's convenient to think of it as a recursive function. Any questions about this? Branch and bound? Okay. If not, let's stop here, and we'll pick up the discussion again in the next class.